So I'm going to give a chalk talk about how we can measure eccentricities from transit light curves. Particularly interested to get input from those of you who work on stars about the ways that we're using stellar properties and whether that makes you nervous, I guess. So there's a number of ways to measure eccentricities from light curves. There's one I'm going to focus on, but I'm going to talk about the other ways so that we start out clear on which way I'm talking about. So measure eccentricity E from the light curve. So one way is that we could use the relative timing of the transit and the eclipse. By timing, I mean the phase. If you're on an elliptical orbit, it may not be half a phase before you see the from the transit to the eclipse. And also the relative duration. Because if you have an elliptical orbit, the speed of the planet will change over the course of the orbit. Because of that, you might also see a change in speed during the transit. Which could lead to a difference in the ingress or egress duration. To my knowledge, this has never been detected since it's such a subtle effect. Maybe there's like one or two cases that I'm not aware of. So this is like often what people think that this tutorial would be about, and unfortunately it's not. You can get information about the eccentricity from transit timing variations.
What is the order of magnitude of the effect? You
see,
we haven't detected it.
It's like a 10 to the minus 3 factor change. And since it's pretty hard usually to constrain the ingress and egress anyway, at least for planets, then that's why it's, even with a pretty elliptical orbit, it's not been possible to detect.
That's okay for our stars.
That's true. It does. It does. Yeah. Yeah, all of these depend on the speed itself, which is, I'll show is related to A over R star. So this is a major axis ratio over the stellar radius. Let me remind myself if there's anything else besides the actual.
Whether the transit secondary eclipse actually happens is also another indication.
That's true. So that's, yeah. Or if you just see the secondary eclipse.
That's also, yeah.
That's right. Was there any other ones I wanted to mention? Oh, you might see a change in the reflected or emitted light. Which I believe was observed by Hubble for a very elliptical planet called HD 80606b. So it's actually seeing its temperature change in the transit light curve with the reflected or emitted light. None of these are what I'm talking about. What I'm going to talk about is the speed of the transit compared to a circular orbit. And this will give us a joint constraint on E, the eccentricity, on omega, which is the longitude of periapse. In the sky plane, which I'll show you a little diagram of a bit later to show you exactly which angle it is that we're getting the joint constraint with. And I'll argue that even though it's a joint constraint, this can still give us some very useful information about the eccentricity. So I'm going to now briefly derive how we can get the stellar density from the light curve, which is actually a combination of the stellar density, the eccentricity, and this longitude of periapse. Because we'll then combine that with our estimate or knowledge of the actual stellar density to get that joint constraint on E and omega. So I'm going to draw a transit light curve. I'll go over here. It may actually have a systematic like that, but I'll try to make it and I'll show you what's happening here. So if we consider so this is the depth. Then if we consider the time from when the half of the planet has entered the star to the other half of the planet leaving the star, that's this duration, T. And that on the transit light curve would be like from here to here. And then we have, I'm going to now draw another planet just for clarity. When the planet first comes in contact with the star to when it's fully on the star, that's tau. So that's the ingress and egress duration, which we'll assume here are the same. Okay, so if we then work in the limit where Rp, the radius of the planet, is much, much less than our star, and where the impact parameter, let me draw the impact parameter. So I'm just drawing another transit. Let's say the planet's going across this chord. The impact parameter is a dimensionless number that's zero if the planet were crossing the equator, and one if the center of the planet were crossing. I shouldn't call this the equator and the pole because it depends on how the star is oriented. But if it's going across the center, it's zero. If it's going right across the edge, it's one. That's the impact parameter, and it has no units. It's dimensionless. So in the limit where the transit impact parameter is much, much less than 1 minus Rp over R star, in other words, it's not a grazing transit, I'm going to give an expression. And you never have to use any of the approximations that I'm going to use, but it will just lead us to a more simple formula that will give you a sense for why this is leading to the stellar density. But if you need to do the full thing, you can and should when you're fitting your transit light curve. So in that case, this duration T, we can write as 2 pi R star square root of 1 minus B squared. So this is counting for the impact parameter affecting the chord. If B is 0, then your duration is not shortened. But if you're doing a smaller chord, it is, divided by B, which is the transit speed. So if we're on a circular orbit, then we can say E circular is just 2 pi A. A is the sum major axis over P. And then we can say this expected duration on a circular orbit, if we substitute that in, is P over pi R star over A, square root of 1 minus B squared. And I'll denote this as circular. Here we assumed a circular orbit. So this is why people often use A over R star as their parameter that they're fitting for the light curve. There's a lot of different parameters you can use to fit your light curve. You could use T itself, tau itself. You'll see it done in a lot of different ways, and as long as you adjust your prior accordingly to give the prior that you want, you can use any of them. Okay, so then we just can use Kepler's law, which is some major axis, cubed, 2 pi over period, squared equals g m star in the limit where mp, the mass of the planet, is much less than the mass of the star. Then we can sub that in, and we'll get t circular equals, let's see, can you even see down here? Okay. 2 to the 2/3. I'm preserving all these like factors of 2s and pi's and stuff just so no one feels concerned that I've like not acquired like a pi to the 7th or something and thrown it away. R star over m star to the 1/3. So now you see, just by substituting with Kepler's law, we got something that looks like the stellar density. And if we want to write it in terms of the stellar density, then we get the 1/3. Actually, let me just underwrite it as everything to the 1/3. 3p over, this is period, remember, rho star pi g. So if we know the orbital period, like if we see multiple transits, we know that, then we can get the stellar density from the transit light curve, assuming a circular orbit. And the most simple way to diagnose an eccentric orbit can be to do just that, like have this be your fit parameter, and then see that it's really different from what you think the actual stellar density is. So if we were doing this with a planet transiting a sun-like star and we saw the density was 100 times solar derived from the light curve, that would be a pretty good indication that we have a planet on elliptical orbit. So then we can approximate that the actual transit velocity is the circular velocity right there times a factor of square root of 1 minus e squared times 1 plus e sine omega. And now I'm going to draw what the normal reference frame is that we use. This is important and confusing. Like I recently, someone like wrote to me about a table that was in my paper, and they're like, I'm not getting the same results. And like, they're like, what's going on? And it turned out they didn't realize I was using this sort of standard observer reference frame, but it's probably not what you'd use if you were someone just modeling the orbit. So let's just define what it is. So if we have, here's the star, we have some orbit around the star, we're looking at it. This, here's the longitude of periaps right here. It's this angle, and it's, the way to remember it is that if omega is 90 degrees, that means it transits at periaps. Okay, so then we can write, we can call this now rho circ. So this is what we measured from our transit light curve, and I'll now show you how it relates to the actual rho star given this relation between the velocities.
Becky, you're approximating v equals 0.
V equals 0. Yes, actually, sorry. I lost something there. This should be where t, yeah, I just lost it, but and then I wanted to Yeah, I accidentally dropped all this. I also wanted to say that tau, this is the total duration, but of course the ingress and egress will also depend on the velocity. So if we can measure, I'll just note this right here, how about, if we can measure both t and tau, we can get both B and rho circ. And in practice, what often happens is that this can be measured pretty well. This can be measured kind of poorly. These two are somewhat correlated. But as long as you fold all that in to your posterior for rho circ, then you've accounted for that degeneracy. And it's particularly a problem for smaller planets because those have very short ingress and egress, so it can be, you can have a pretty weak constraint on this and a lot of degeneracy with these two parameters. So yeah, thank you for that question.
Can I ask a question on the,
oh, yes.
The assumption in the middle, right? So that RP is much smaller than our star and we don't have a gradient transit. You said that this, it's an assumption you can make for these derivations, but you don't have to.
Yes.
Model the transit. So how often is that actually done?
I don't think it's ever done. I think I'm only, I've not seen any transit software that makes that assumption.
So that means you can actually, if you just have a grazing transit, can still, that doesn't preclude you from actually doing this exercise of checking whether a transit is in.
That's correct. In practice, though, if you have a grazing transit, then there's a lot of degeneracy among RP over R star, rho circ B. It's very difficult to constrain the eccentricity when you do have a grazing transit, but that assumption is usually not made. Usually people use Mandel and Eagle transit model it doesn't assume a grazing transit. I mean, it doesn't assume a non-grazing transit.
Also, does Lindbergh mess you up only in the limit of extreme grazing transit or something?
So that's another, there can be some degeneracy with limb darkening. In practice, when I do this, I don't see a strong correlation with the limb darkening parameters, but you definitely want to fold that into your posterior distribution on rho circ, all the uncertainty in the limb darkening. It does, yeah. In practice, I haven't seen it be super correlated, but it definitely should be taken into account. And in practice, a lot of times, I think most other people fit the limb darkening parameters, even if we think we know what they are from stellar models, just to make sure we're being as conservative as possible and getting realistic uncertainties. Great, thank you. Other questions? Okay, yeah, stellar people, please look out for cases where you're like, wait, no, that's a good thing to do. Okay.
But so to get back to that, do we have a sense how often that happens? Like rather than taking a model atmosphere and limb darkening coefficients and perhaps putting a prior item or even fixing them rather than just for in the literature in general? I mean, that's not a question you can answer.
I have seen people do that. I don't do it myself. I usually use a two-parameter limb darkening model and just assume that we know nothing, even if
so
we might know a bit.
For the upper course, we use priors. Because for many of these cases, if we don't do that, huge also.
Why is that?
Because for Kepler and for the cooler M dwarfs, that means you have very strong limb darkening effects in terms of really dark. For the hotter stars, it's not very much.
Okay, that's good to know.
So it's not like you don't know anything about limb darkening.
Yeah, we had a bit of discussion. So Pierre Wexler was here in the first few weeks, and he showed some results from some binaries where you actually measured limb darkening, and he showed it actually looks pretty well as long as you stick around the sun. But as you move to away from the sun, so we have some work that we're working on with Tim White and Chara to measure limb darkening directly using interferometry, and it gets a bit dicey once you move away from the sun.
But if it was not that bad, we would be, yeah, we would have problems between the agreement between the barometry and the Gaia consistency. That would be bad.
And it may also depend on the planet sizes. Like, since you're doing M dwarfs, it's probably mostly smaller planets. With giant planets, it's easier to constrain the limb darkening. Like, I had a table and a paper that had the limb darkening parameters I just derived, but with no prior. One of the co-authors was like, "Ooh, that's actually kind of useful." It wasn't a great constraint, but it was even enough to be useful with a giant planet. But with a small planet, you're probably, unless you do like a huge data set, you're probably not getting much constraint. Great. So we can relate rho circ to the true stellar density by 1 plus e sine omega square root of 1 minus e squared rho star cubed. So I'm going to draw a couple examples, but this gives us a sense that for very elliptical orbits, this can be a pretty useful diagnostic. And I'll talk a little bit at the end about like when this is fairly trustworthy versus when you might have more concerns. But for example, like I first got interested in this because I was trying to find planets on really elliptical orbits, eccentricities above 0.9. If you have an eccentricity above 0.9, you're going to infer a density 100 times bigger than what you think the stellar density is. So even if you have a lot of uncertainty in the stellar properties, or even if there's some systematic error, it's quite useful for diagnosing that elliptical orbit. So I'm going to now draw what I'm going to draw is rho circ over rho star as a function of the longitude of periaps for a couple different values of the eccentricity. So, okay, this is going to be 0.01, 0.1. Okay, so, here's 0, 90, 180, 270, 360. So I'm going to start by drawing E eccentricity of 0.91. We do know of planets that are that elliptical and want to find more because we think there should be more out there. In that case, if the planet is transiting at periaps, which is actually geometrically the most likely because that's also where the transit probability is highest, you would infer a density 100 times what you think the stellar density is. And then if it's transiting at apoaps, that would be less likely but could happen, then it would be 0.01 times the density that you think. And it crosses zero at about 40 degrees away from 270, or I should say it crosses one right here-ish. So we have, and then at omega equals zero, which is sometimes called semilattice rectum, that then it's about 20. So it sort of looks like. This is just approximate. Okay, so for most possible omegas, you're going to have a stellar density, if your eccentricity is 0.91, for most possible omegas, you're going to have a stellar density that's wildly different from any estimate of the true stellar density that you made. And those are also the configurations that are most likely to transit. Let's say you have an eccentricity of 0.64. I chose that because that's going to knock you down to 10 right here and up to 0.1 right here. So then it would look more like this. And let's say your eccentricity were 0.1, then you're gonna stick, you get up to like a factor of 1.33, you're gonna stick pretty close to this particular analog scale.
0.91, the top?
Yeah, this is 0.91 and this is 0.64. And this is eccentricity at 0.1. So, and some plots that I will show you in a few minutes, you'll see that the real challenge and where you really benefit from having a good stellar density is when you have eccentricities that are low and you want to either know that they're low for sure or even actually try to measure them. But when the eccentricities are high, you'll see that you don't really necessarily need a great stellar density to be able to get a good measurement. So then, okay, a couple things. First, this immediately tells you that if you measure, let's say you measured rho circ over rho star is 10. So we're going to pretend that's what we got. First of all, you're immediately going to get a minimum eccentricity. Let's say, well, let me, I'm going to go over here. So we measured rho circ over rho star is 10. We get Vmin is 0.64. This is why you sometimes hear people saying this technique only gives you a minimum eccentricity. That's kind of true, but I'll argue that you get your posterior is better than if you literally just had the minimum. But you do get a minimum. But then, so let's see, here's this line, this horizontal line. It's going through curves of higher eccentricity as well. But for those curves of higher eccentricity, you need a very special value for omega to cross that line. You only cross in one point, whereas it's lying very tangent to this minimum. So if I bumped up to 0.65, it would still be lying tangent, or 0.66. But once I get up to much higher eccentricity, it's like just a tiny fraction of angles that are going to give you that ratio. So you'll see your posterior is really weighted toward that minimum eccentricity. And this is without imposing any sort of prior on the eccentricity. You might also just say, like, I think eccentric planets are less common. You can say that, but even without saying that, you're most likely near the minimum eccentricity. And you'll see that when I show some of the examples.
Dumb question, but the prior on omega is just as uniform.
Yes, that's right. And in doing this analysis, you automatically, well, I'll show you, I'll give you some steps on, like, practically then what you would do, but you're automatically incorporating the transit probability just by the fact that if you generate combinations of E and omega and period that don't transit, that won't be a good fit to the transit light curve. So that's why by assuming a uniform prior on omega, it's like uniform in the intrinsic, not in what we would detect because of the transit probability. It's just like out in space, how are they oriented? Yeah.
But I think it is somewhat more subtle than that, because you might think, depending on how you're planning on using these results, you might include the fact that it transits as a piece of data in your fit, and then you would get a different prior on omega.
Well, so, but yeah, I think that is what I'm trying to say. When procedurally what you do when you fit the light curve, that's already accounted for.
I don't think that's true.
We should talk more about this.
I think that's not true, because it depends. Anyway, it depends on whether or not you're going to do a population study with it and account for the transit probability later.
Yeah, let's talk afterwards, because
there's a lot of confusion in the literature about this.
Okay, we should talk afterwards, because at least with the procedure that I'm going to describe, we spend a lot of time convincing ourselves that the transit probability had automatically been accounted for, but okay. I'm fully open-minded that we might be wrong about that. So I'm guessing it might depend on what parameters you're using in your transit bit. No, you don't, okay. Well, we'll talk afterwards, and we'll talk, and then we'll update everyone else on the Slack channel.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
So there are scenarios where the priors might not be uniform, and I agree with Dan's comment that in the literature it's a bit of a mess, but that is when you have more than one planet, and you get to say which orbits are stable or which are most likely dynamical. So things like apsidal alignment, where you actually probably have some prior on. That you could assert on the orbit based on the stability.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a very good point. In a multi-planet system, the stability itself can be a prior. And also a prior on the eccentricity.
Yeah.
Okay. So, in practice, I'll show you what I tend to do in terms of like the actual procedure. So first I obtain a posterior for rho star. And the way that I tend to do that, you can use whatever your preferred method is that I take T effective log G FE over H, preferably from spectra, but I've also taken them from the Kepler input parameter that was only based on, Kepler input catalog that was only based on photometry. So then a lot of these are super uncertain. I compute on a linear grid, stellar models in stellar. I'm not explaining this well. I take something like the Dartmouth models or the YY models, and then I compute what's the probability of T effective times P log G. For each trial model, given what we observed, what's the probability? So practically, okay, so like let's say the stellar evolution model says T effective is 5,000 and the spectra said it was like 5,500 plus or minus 100, and we're assuming that there's a Gaussian posterior from the spectra, then it would be just an exponential of what's the probability that the actual stellar temperature is 5,000 given that we observed it to be 5,100 and there is an uncertainty of 100. Multiply these all together and compare it to a uniform random number, and then keep all the ones where that random number is less than this. So rather than, personally, this is just how I do it, rather than trying to do an MCMC and interpolate or any of that, I just am taking all these stellar models that I've sometimes reweighted to get the prior that I want, and then comparing them to the spectroscopic or photometric parameters and keeping all the ones that pass this random number test.
Well, one question is, what kind of stars are you typically working at? Because the techniques, from a stellar point of view, you would use would be different on the unevolved lower main sequence than they would be in the solar type domain.
Yeah, so so that's a good question. And in what I've done, where I've used these techniques, I've limited it to stars with log G greater than 4, so not too evolved, and temperatures between 4,800 and 6,400 Kelvin.
Yeah, because from a lot of practice in this case, if you're on the lower main sequence, the mass-luminosity relationship is super powerful, and the mass-radius relationship you can define. And actually, I would argue that you are probably going to get a much more precise answer by reference to theoretical isochrony tend to be observed, things like the gravities, which are going to have a big scatter, right? The only thing you have to worry about is binaries and things like that, which you could account for, or tech. If you're on the upper main sequence, that is upper in quotes meaning solar type stars, big stars instead of, you know, point threes or whatever it is, then I agree with you that you actually have a real physical dynamic range in gravity and things like that you'd have to account for. And then in that case, direct reference, and spectroscopic numbers are probably better there too. But that might be an interesting thing to explore because certainly in the case when we look at star clusters, if you look at like spectroscopic gravity, there's just a much, much bigger scatter than there is in the photometry or world sequence.
I mean, now so, in the age of Gaia, this is
also. Yeah. So,
so the block genes are less useful in large problems.
Well, they tell you something in subgenes, and that's why I was asking if you're worried about stars that are like in between the main sequence.
Yeah, I'm throwing the whole grid. Exactly. Yeah. So, what you're suggesting that this part is probably not providing much constraint, but still is okay to have in there?
Yeah. Or you'd have to check and see whether or not frequently the spectroscopic gravities, for example, in the Apogee case, the spectroscopic gravities for the dwarfs are known to be just off. Right. So they would actually be biasing your answer relative to the answer you would get just from the luminosities.
That's good to know. So you might not really want to use that at all. Yeah. So that's really good to know that you might want to remove terms or also add terms. Like with a recent paper we did, we used the Gaia parallax in here too, so we just had another term multiplying.
Yeah. Well, that's what I meant. So I mean, nowadays with the Gaia luminosities, the fact that the spectroscopy doesn't give you a good constraint of energy because it's not, there's so many things that can broaden your lines apart from pressure broadening. That I think it's best to just forget about.
Well, so that's very helpful. That's helpful to know, because if it's just that this is providing a weak constraint, that's not a big deal. But if it might be systematically wrong or uncertainties estimated, then throwing it out would actually be better. So, okay, that's good to know, and actually useful for me because The place where we applied this to a big sample was we did a study looking for Jupiters on very elliptical orbits. So then we had about 50 Kepler light curves that we were using this procedure on. Now they have updated parameters from Dan and Travis using the Gaia data. So maybe even those that have spectroscopic log Gs, maybe that should be thrown out. Though I've actually talked to I will be talking to them about they maybe be able to provide something like this that's better than what I can compute using this kludgy method.
So of course you have a sanity check in the cases where the star has astroseismology, because then you get a really good rogue star.
Yeah, so that's...
So is there any overlap between your stars and the stars that were Kepler things?
So
at least some astroseismology.
Yeah, that is an excellent point. I think with the stars in my sample, there weren't any, but there's a study, as I'm sure you know, by Vincent van Eelen that just does this for stars with astroseismology and gets really good constraints on eccentricities. Though I'll show in a moment that it's most useful for the low eccentricities to have those tight constraints. Okay, so then you get rho circ from your light curve. What you could do instead is, in your light curve model, have E and omega be your parameters, and also include this as like a regularization term. In practice, we're doing this less straightforward thing because it's faster, but that would probably technically be the correct thing. It's equivalent, but you should feel free to do that if you have, if you can run your fits fast enough using that approach. So in that case, you would put this rho star as a term in your likelihood as you're fitting the transit light curves, and then you'd have E and omega be free parameters in your light curve fit. In practice, what we do is have this be a free parameter in our light curve fit, and then we do an extra step where we fit E and omega to these two combined posteriors. And if you want to, if you find yourself having to do that and you want to see exactly what you do, you can see our paper, Dawson and Johnson 2012. As I was working on this, I was like, oh my goodness, I can't believe that was 2012. That was like 7 years ago. But we tried to make this fairly pedagogical, so maybe it will be of use to someone still. Let's see. Okay. So then I am going to jump into showing you now the slides of some joint distributions on E and omega to give you a sense for how they're affected by your stellar density. So these are draws from a fake, this was fake, but pretend. It's draws from the posterior of periapse versus eccentricity, joint constraint. And we're gonna start with a case where the orbit in real life is circular, and we measured a stellar density from the light curve that's the same as our stellar density from the model. I then assumed different uncertainties on the stellar density from the model. These plots would actually look the same if this same uncertainty was in the stellar density from the light curve. It's equivalent that way since it's just, it's equivalent. So you could also imagine if your light curve constraint got worse and worse, what the posteriors would look like. So you can see, I was supposed to turn off this light. You can also see, so this is a joint draws, and then there's also a red histogram that's the eccentricity, marginalized eccentricity posterior. So this is how good your constraint is in the case of the circular orbit. A couple features to point out. So like we have a circular orbit, there's always some special value of the longitude of periapse that you can have such that you secretly have a super elliptical orbit and it still is the same light curve density and stellar density. That's sort of the unavoidable degeneracy with this method. That being said, if you wanted to then follow up with radial velocity, this might give you a phase that you want to measure at to quickly break that degeneracy. So you can see, in this case, having the better constraint on the stellar density can help quite a lot. You still always have, like even in this best case, it's like, well, we just can't rule out that it might still be an elliptical orbit that's oriented just right. But at least your median value is reflecting the low eccentricity that you have. And so this is why it was necessary, say in Vincent van Eylen's study, to have the astroseismology. If he's trying to distinguish, he's looking at like small, closely packed planets, he's trying to distinguish do they have eccentricities of 0 or 0.3. Well, if you only had this type of constraint on the stellar density, which this could be if you only had like photometric data for the star and the original Kick catalog, this is useless in telling is it an eccentricity of 0 or 0.3. Whereas this, particularly if you're looking at a whole collection of planets like he was, can distinguish, okay, they're mostly on circular orbits because it's for any given planet there's this degeneracy, but it's unlikely that they're all like have their ellipse specially pointed in the direction such that it has exactly the transit speed you'd get from a circular orbit. So here, having a better stellar density is helping quite a lot. However, as we dial up the eccentricity, that assistance kind of goes away. It's still the case that if you have, this is now an eccentricity of 0.3, longitude of periapse of 40 degrees. This is like what we'd, the two-dimensional posterior that we'd measure. The one with the less uncertainty stellar density is tighter with the degeneracy. And if you were able to break it with RV follow-up, you'd rather be in this situation than in this one. But in practice, if all you have is the light curves and you can't break the degeneracy, then you're not really being aided, particularly from going from 10% to 1%. You didn't gain any real knowledge of the eccentricity just because you're still suffering from this degeneracy. Then here's eccentricity of 0.91, longitude of periapsis of 90 degrees. Now you're getting actually a very nice tight constraint on the eccentricity. It's not just a minimum, it's what I talked about, that you're more favored to be near the minimum. And you're tightening, but just not being all that helped out by having this really nice stellar density in this case. But this originally was very comforting to me because I was looking for Jupiters on very elliptical orbits, and this told me that having not so great stellar parameters, as long as there wasn't some systematic problem, was probably not affecting my results too much. And in a moment, I'll talk about what cases you're more robust to uncertainties in stellar parameters and in which cases you aren't. Okay. I know I have another plot, but I can't remember if I... Oh, yeah, here's some examples, and then I will go into a few caveats about when I think you should use this approach and when you shouldn't. These are all my examples because it's just what I had on hand. So here's Kepler-419b. This was a planet orbiting a tiny bit evolved F-dwarf, maybe not even evolved, but if evolved just a tiny bit, where there was about a 30% uncertainty in the stellar density. And this allowed us to identify the planet as being on an elliptical orbit with an eccentricity of about 0.8. So then here, this two-dimensional posterior is just from the light curve, but we subsequently did radial velocity follow-up, and that's the value on here in red. This is TOI-172b. I just happened to have this plot from an observing proposal. I didn't actually work on the paper about this system, but this is where they had a G subgiant, about a 6% uncertainty in the stellar density, because they did fold in the Gaia information, I think that's why. This is what we'd get from the light curve. It's not a great constraint, but it is hinting that there's some eccentricity, that it's probably not a circular orbit. And then this is what they got with their radial velocity follow-up. And if you had this to begin with, then this could also suggest some more favorable observing times if you had limited observing time for exactly when you want to get the RV to break the degeneracy. And of course, you can combine the light curves and radial velocities once you have both of them, and that's often very good. Yeah?
How many times can you do that one, because one thing of interest for us, the astroseismologists in the room, is for stars that are somewhat evolved to get an independent check on the mean stellar density that we can
from the light curve.
From the light, well, if you have very good RVs and very good light curve, you can get a mean stellar density that's independent of the seismology and compare it to as how fundamentally they actually agree. And I think there's only two already where we've done this in the past. It might be interesting to do this more systematically.
You are, but this all incorporates the uncertainty. But you're right, since that is contributing to the uncertainty, it would be probably better for a larger planet. But that would also be better for getting the RV constraint on the eccentricity. So I think you probably want to use a giant planet for that purpose.
Because we have calibrators for the seismic density, so rare.
Yeah.
Right. There's one potential way to do it.
Yeah.
It only gives you R. Mass is hard to come by.
And eclipsing binaries can be biased because of activity, and it's difficult to find subgiants that they survive because of the evolution. So you're right. It's actually surprisingly true calibrators are surprisingly rare.
Yeah. So that could be handy. I mean, I know people already assume that things might be tidally circularized, so its eccentricity is zero for that reason. So those would also join places where it's reasonable, or if it's like a tightly packed multi-planet system, then there's probably some constraint on the eccentricity from the stability. So so doing what you suggested could be great, but then also consider things, you know, the eccentricity is close to zero from being tidally circularized. Yeah.
But then if we were to get a mean density quite different from what we see you get from astral seismology, then we would really be in deep shit.
I'm not talking about the solar
type. The mean density is so tightly constrained by the last frequency separation. So as soon as we have that, of course we'd be wrong. I mean, clearly, but
I agree.
But it would be very interesting to be wrong.
This can go wrong if you have a blind
of
another star.
That would be a good point. Yes, that's a very good
ratio, which means egress egress ratios.
Yeah, that absolutely, having a blend can affect it. There's a paper by David Kipping where he talks about blends and other problematic effects. One that he talks about and Vincent does too is also TTVs. If you don't model the TTVs, then your transit can get a bit smeared out, and that can also affect the ingress and egress. So, yeah, there are a lot of caveats. I think that I'll talk more about this in a moment. The most, at least for me, the best case is like identifying things on very elliptical orbits. Once it comes to where you really need to be quite precise, like you're trying to get the exact stellar density, or you're trying to say the eccentricity is low, then you have to be a lot more careful about those effects. Effects blends and TTVs are not going to make something look like it has an eccentricity of 0.9 when it's an eccentricity of 0, but it could have a subtle effect, like the difference between eccentricity of 0.1 and 0. So particularly if you're in that sort of scientific application, you might have to be a bit more careful. Yeah?
Just go back to your previous plot.
Yeah.
Thanks. I'm just trying to see, is there an easy way to understand why improving your knowledge of the stellar density makes no difference to the eccentricity? Is it?
Yeah, I think it's just because you still have this whole, like this has now gotten a lot narrower, but you still have this degeneracy between.
But in terms of the like if you're trying to have it really fast, that's a giveaway that it's a really eccentric system.
Yes, and that's like this case, yeah.
Is there another, is that the only feature of the light curve that's constraining you, or is there another feature, like is it also tau that's constraining you, or
what
light curve tells you this is, wow, this is really eccentric?
So it's, you definitely need both the total duration and the ingress and egress, because that will let you distinguish if it's fast because of the speed or if it's fast because it's high impact parameter. If you want to bring it, you can bring in potentially some of those other light curve effects I mentioned at the beginning. Of course, with the primary and secondary eclipse, once you get to long orbital periods, you don't expect those anyway, so that's of limited use. Maybe the change in speed, though, as I mentioned, that's extremely difficult to detect. So if you want to break this degeneracy, radial velocity follow-up, that's one way. Stability analysis, if it's a multi-planet system.
I find it interesting that the star could have any density you like, and it would not change your derivation, your value of eccentricity. You could replace it.
Yeah, I mean, at some point it would, but this is what.
50% is enormous, right? So
this is more, to say more precisely, I assumed it was a mean of solar and then a standard deviation of 50% of that, and then I truncated it so that there were no negative densities.
So that's the cube that's
ready. Yeah, that's a very good point. This cube.
So E becomes comparable to 1, and then
right.
It goes.
Yeah, so it's very strongly dependent on eccentricity.
Yeah.
I guess that's what I was asking.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, having the cubed it's what allows you to identify these elliptical orbits, but because of it, improving the stellar density is not.
So I don't want to delay what you want to show because I know we're running short of time, but one thing, I don't know if anybody's looked at this, is if you have a light curve in a different wavelength bandpass,
yeah,
how much better you could constrain the impact parameter. and therefore improve everything else here that we talked about.
Realistic. Well, that helps, but you should just consider that improving the impact parameter has the same effect. Like this 1%, 10%, 50%, it could either be the stellar density or the density that you got from the light.
I agree in this case, but if you,
in general,
for the low eccentricity cases, which are the predominant case, that one thing this group could think about, because there are people who are expert on this in the field, is basically, what we could do to improve our eccentricity estimates by measuring it at wavelengths and paths, and what that would be.
Yeah, that is a great point.
So I carry that one more thought. These are detected by TESS or Kepler, but Kepler is not the same bandpass as TESS, or the same bandpass as Spitzer, or the same bandpass as KEOPS, or the same bandpass as LACHA.
Yeah. That is a good point, that for stars where you have those multiple data sets, that's extremely useful. For some special systems, there's probably also some Spitzer HST. Yeah. Okay. These are the, actually, let me just say one more thing about this one. So here, this is the test system that I at one point showed a slide about in the plot update that we have a recent paper about it, K-dwarf with 8% uncertainty. Here, we actually compared and then used together the TTV constraints on the eccentricity, and there's an agreement there that helps improve the fit, that the outer one seems very consistent with a circular orbit, both from the TTVs and the transit light curve, and the inner one, there's a hint of eccentricity. This one is somewhat poorly constrained because it's a grazing transit, so there's a lot of uncertainty introduced by the uncertainty in the impact parameter. That indeed might be a case where another wavelength could help out. Then just a couple caveats on when you want to use this and when you don't. So I'm going to turn this off now. Oops, sorry.
In case you were dozing off.
So I'll just list these and then we can conclude. I would say for identifying highly elliptical orbits where you see rho circ is much, much larger than your estimate of rho star, I feel that that's a fairly robust use. More caution is needed if it's a circular orbit with uncertain or biased stellar parameters. Also, caution needed when rho circ is small, because maybe it's just an unidentified giant. So that's why I have more trust in, like, the case of, say, Kepler 419, where you see this really big rho circ. The actual density of the star is not going to be like 20 solar. This is good. Here, you get a low rho circ from the light curve. Maybe you just are completely wrong about the type of star. That's more of an issue. And it's trickier for smaller planets. Though possible with astroseismology, like the Van Eelen study, which was all small planets. And there's also more of a modeling paper by Ellen Price called How Low Can You Go? That tries to answer the question of when this breaks down for smaller planets. Okay, so thank you. Final questions or comments?
Just on the giants, that's where astroseismology really can help, because giants have such strong and slow oscillations that if you can see a transit, you can almost always see oscillations. So they're much easier to do seismology on them than main signal stars.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good sample to be using, assuming you can detect the transits as well. Any other questions?
I brought up a point last Friday, Plato looking at Earth-sized planets around sun-like stars and how the impact parameter degeneracy will affect your inference of the radius measurement of the planet relative to the star.
Yeah.
And so that's a place where the stellar density can help as well. Now, you have to assume some distribution for the extra superplanet, perhaps, but that actually could maybe improve your measurement of the planet parameters from the end, breaking the impact parameter degeneracy using this inductive. You can't measure the very well.
Yeah, that's a great point, because all three of those parameters are covariant, the radius, planet radius to star radius ratio, and the impact parameter, and the Rho Circ or Aver R star, whatever you want to call it. Yeah. Other questions or comments? Okay, thank you. Yes, there will actually be a talk on Thursday by Eric about photodynamical analysis, where this is all automatically built in. And Eric's also giving the UCSB colloquium today, so we put information about that on the channel. And join us for the MESA tutorial tomorrow as well.
And the barbecue tonight.